thank you for the organizer for inviting me here. It's nice to be here again. I was around here in 1995 for a few weeks, so I was very glad to be invited back here. And let me also comment that I'm very glad that this conflict with strings was noticed and it's not going to be there in the future. It's very unusual circumstances that allowed me to be here, and it would be nice in the future people don't have to make a choice. Anyway, so the other warning I have to tell you about is that this talk, this title is a little bit of a bait and switch. what I was going to talk about is some general overview of string theory, but this is a very large subject and I only have 45 minutes. So what I really want to do now is talk about 2 points, maybe 3 points, about string theory and tie them all together through this idea of background independence. So the outline of the talk is as follows. So I'm going to start with an introduction and basically talk a little bit about background independence, raise some questions, which I'm not going to answer, and give a more detailed outline of this talk. And then I'm going to talk a little bit, basically a historical approach, a little bit about perturbative string theory. Perturbative string theory is a theory that we usually think about as background dependent, and this raises very concrete issues, but it's a little bit hard to make that notion concrete. So I'm going to talk a little bit about in what sense this is background dependent, in what sense it's background independent. Then I'm going to move on to basically the mid-90s and talk about some facts that are relevant for the discussion, okay? Not directly about background independence, but some facts that we discovered about string theory that you might find interesting. So this would be an interlude in the sense that it's not going to be directly related to quantum gravity. This is going to be the subject of dualities in just ordinary gauge theories with no gravity. And in particular, this will lead us to rethinking about the role of gauge invariance in quantum field theories. Then I'm going to move back to quantum gravity, talk a little bit about non-perturbative string theory. In addition to dualities, in which everything I said about gauge theory still applies, there's a new notion of holography that we, at least in string theory community, find interesting. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about what those holographic dualities tell us about background independence, and then give some conclusions. I guess the habit in these talks is that there's not going to be any questions during the talk, and then, okay. Okay, so background independence has provided guidance in quantum gravity research, also in string theory, and it will probably continue doing so. And as I said in the introduction, as we learned more about both string theory and quantum field theory, we learned some facts that you might find relevant to the subject. Okay? The concept of gauge invariance or background independence has been in some sense transformed by learning a little bit more about non-perturbative physics. So in particular, I only want to talk about two major concepts, that one of duality and that one of holography, and more or less reflect of how they change the way we think about quantum physics and also in passing the question of background independence. Okay? So the question that I'm going to have in the back of my mind, none of this question is going to be answered in this talk, of course, is, first of all, what precisely is background independence? I find that when I talk to people about that, the notion is very fuzzy. Everybody has their own idea what it is exactly. And this, of course, transforms as you learn more about physics. Is it a property of the formulation or is it a property of the physics, for example? This is a question that comes very relevant when you start talking about dualities. Dualities, a preview of what I'm going to talk about later, is the idea that the same physics could be expressed in different variables. So you have to question whether a particular property, a particular notion that you're interested in is a property of the physics, or is it a property of a particular set of variables. Okay? And in order to distinguish between the two, it's good to keep in mind what do we need it for precisely. What do we need background independence for? What kind of background independence do we need? How much of it do we need? How much of it can we expect? How much of it is going to be too much? Okay? Again, none of these questions are going to be answered here, but it's the type of questions that good to keep in mind. Okay. Also, a question that's going to be very relevant later in the talk is, what are the ways of realizing background independence? So there are many ways of trying to find a background independent formulation of quantum gravity, and I think it's good to reflect on what are the possible ways of realizing that idea, okay? And we'll see that there are going to be some range of possibilities, okay? Okay, so let me start. So in the beginning, long time ago, in 1994, more or less till 1990, where the first non-perturbative formulation of string theory emerged, there was the notion of perturbative strings, and this is still more or less the way that most people visualize string theory, okay? And in some sense, this is a little bit outdated. In some sense, this is still a good way of visualizing the theory, okay? So the best way of visualizing the theory is you think about one-dimensional object. It could be open or it could be closed. Okay, it's just a vibrating loop of strings. Okay, it's embedded in some manifold, in some space-time. The space-time is given. All the structure of this space-time is given. It's a given background. Okay, and the string propagates in that background. It's a relativistic string, so a lot of intuition that you have about strings don't really apply. But nevertheless, this is the way you visualize the theory, and the word background is highlighted here. In order to formulate the perturbation series, you have to choose a manifold in which these strings propagate. Okay? So we have the usual formulation in which you have the coordinate of the strings as a function of location and as a function of time, and the strings, as it propagate in time, sweeps the world sheet of the string, and then the coordinate is some mapping from the world sheet into the given space-time. Okay? And you do a path integral, and you weigh the path integral by the action. I write the action in the Polyakov form. Let's see if anybody can see that. So this is the space-time metric, and this is in Euclidean world sheet in conformal gauge. Those details don't matter. And this is the action. And again, in order to formulate what the action is, I use this space-time background, which is a given. Okay? And this is, again, the way to visualize that. The full story is much more intricate. For example, what defines for you a string theory is not really a space-time. It's a conformal field theory in which sometimes there is a space-time geometrical interpretation. Most times there's not. Many times there are more than one. So it's not really true to say that you are given a space-time, you're given a more abstract object in which space-time is just one of the possibilities. Okay? So when we talk about background, generally we're not talking about background geometry, we're talking about the background, which is a more abstract object. Okay? But for now, if we want to visualize what it is, this formulation will do. So the question is it background independent? And we all want to say, no, it's not, because in order to formulate this, to begin with, in order to formulate a perturbation series, and again, I didn't give you the complete formulation, you use the given space-time metric, okay? G mu nu, as I wrote before, is the background space-time metric. It appears explicitly in the formulation. So this sounds a lot like background dependence. We would like to say that this is a background-dependent theory, okay? But what do we mean precisely by that, okay? In what sense is it background-dependent? So, in fact, what we get here is the generalization of general relativity. If you, instead of talking about a world sheet, you're talking about a world line of a particle, you would get a particular formulation of general relativity in a background field gauge, okay? So G mu nu should be thought about as the background field in which you fix the gauge, and all physical observables are shown to be diffeomorphism invariant. This is an exercise that people go through when they learn string theory. So when you change the metric and you change all physical quantities you're interested in by diffeomorphisms, all physical results are the same. Okay? So the theory is diffeomorphism invariant. And we usually don't call general relativity or gauge theory or scalar theory or anything background dependent just because we expand around a particular background or just because we choose a gauge. Similarly, we don't say that Lorentz invariant is broken just because we work in Hamiltonian formulation. Okay? This just means that we have an inconvenient formulation in which we chose already, or the formalism chose for us already a gauge, a background gauge, and background independence is not manifest, okay? And this is true indeed. Background independence is not manifest in string perturbation theory, and the result, which require more than perturbation around one background, therefore are invisible for us. This is a really serious practical problem, okay? So we'd like to do better. So the analogy that you can have in mind is very simple. Let's talk about quantum mechanics of a single degree of freedom, just particle moving on a line. Subject choose some potential. So the analogy of string perturbation theory is like any other perturbation theory. Generally, this potential will have a lot of minima, a lot of maxima. It will have features. So in order to do string perturbation theory, you choose one of these classical backgrounds. It could be a minimum or a maximum. And you expand this small perturbation around that classical background. So the only information we have about the theory is the behavior in the vicinity of this minima. Okay? And this is clearly enough for some things. Study of small fluctuation around a given background. But it's not enough for other things. For example, in this model, you know that after a long time, the particle will sit at the global minimum. And in perturbation theory around a particular background, you won't be able to see which one is the global minimum. Okay? So this is an example of some quantity, some question that you would like to answer and you cannot do, if you only have perturbation theory. Okay? So in the conclusion of that part, we do want a formulation of string theory which treats all possible configuration, all possible backgrounds equally. Such manifest background independence formulation will be extremely useful if it exists. We have to keep in mind that just because we want it doesn't mean that we are guaranteed to find it. And this may have been the expectation in that period. We'd have some background independent, non-perturbative formulation. For example, a lot of attempts at that period concentrated on string field theory. And it will make things like vacuum selections easier. Okay? Now, even then, there are already caveats. For example, even if you have one scalar field coupled to gravity with a specific potential, you can get yourself very, very confused about things like vacuum selection in a cosmological context. But let's brush that aside for now. Okay. I'm tempted to ask if there are questions, but I guess I'll have to wait for that. Sorry?
It's up to you. Do you want to add questions in the middle of this one?
Okay, so I'm finished with part one. Any questions? Yeah.
Sure. Do you get the action for G in some aspect?
No, that's right. G is chosen for you. So there's no way to compare different space-time with different Gs. Yeah. Because it's first quantization and not second quantization.
Yeah. Okay. And what you get very clear during your explanation of this, but if the perturbation was actually convergent,
yeah,
then the choice of this background behavior, you said, would be only inconvenient. But knowing that it is not convergent, some of it.
Well, if it was convergent, that would mean that there are no non-perturbative effects which means two things. First of all, the perturbation theory is sufficient to describe all the physics, and secondly, that it's really boring theory. Because most theories under harmonic oscillators will have the same issue.
I agree.
Yeah. Okay, good. So I'll ask for questions in the middle. More natural for me. Okay. Okay, so this was more or less the description of what happens in the mid-80s. And now we're more or less two decades later, and we learned a lot of things. And some of those things are things that we expected. Some of those things are things that we didn't expect. Okay? So we learned a lot, first of all, about non-perturbative field theory, okay, theories with no gravity, then about non-perturbative string theory, and then we learned that those things are not as distinct as we thought they were. So we understand much better the non-perturbative structure of many quantum theories, with or without gravity. Of course, we don't understand it completely, but we understand it better, so we have more clues. And the main new ingredient in all those studies, both in string theory and in gauge theory, is that of duality. And it changes radically how we think about many things, among which is the question of gauge invariance. This is the question I'm going to concentrate on. This is one of the messages of this talk. And I'll start with ordinary quantum field theory because it's a simpler context. It's much more familiar to most people. But most of what I have to say about quantum field theory without gravity will also carry through unchanged for the gravitational theory. Okay, so later we'll be back to quantum gravity. So let's start with quantum gauge theory. And just to be a little bit more concrete, I'm going to give you one specific example, but it doesn't really matter, the details. I'm not going to supply all the details, in fact. But take, for example, an SUN gauge theory with NF flavors. So SUN gauge theory, the fundamental degrees of freedom are gluons. And if you have flavors, you add some fundamentals, things that look like quarks, okay, and underquarks. And since we like to calculate things exactly, we add minimal supersymmetry. We believe that most of the qualitative details don't depend on that assumption, but we can only calculate things precisely when we add supersymmetry, because now we're discussing field theories at strong coupling. Okay? Now assume for simplicity this range of parameter, there is a window for the number of colors with respect to the number of flavors. It's not too large and it's not too small. Okay? And importantly, in this regime, the theory is confining. Okay. So in perturbation theory, you think you understand this theory. This is the theory, as I said, of quarks and gluons. Or in other words, to be slightly more formal, the Hilbert space of the theory is some large Fock space. You start with some vacuum, and then you act with creation operators. The creation operators are some modes of the fundamental field, the quarks and gluons. But then you still have to impose gauge invariance. So you have a lot of states that are unphysical, and you mod out by some constraints, Gauss law constraints that come from gauge invariance. So this is a Hamiltonian formulation. And what you have is a physical Hilbert space, which is a large Hilbert space modded out by constraint. Okay? So the question arises naturally, I think, and this is the question that leads into dualities. Only states in the physical Hilbert space are physical, and those are, in this particular case, hadrons. So these are actually the states, because the theory is confining, actually the physical state that can propagate. Only operators that commute with the constraints are measurable. So what is the role of all this auxiliary structure? You have a huge Hilbert space. Most of those states are not ever going to be seen. And you have redundancies and you have constraint. And what is the role of this? Okay. So we now suspect that these have to do with perturbation theory only. In other words, with specific classical limit of the quantum theory. These are not features that define for you the quantum theory. Those are not fundamental principles that you should think about. These are just associated with specific classical limits. And this is because of the phenomena of duality. So it turns out in this specific case, and again, the details really don't matter at all. This is a generic phenomena. It happens in many, many cases. There's another gauge theory, which you go on and quantize. The same way that you quantize the original gauge theory, you have a large Hilbert space, you mode out by some gate invariance, and you get precisely the same low energy physics. So these are the details of the theory. It's another gauge theory with different number of colors, the same number of flavors, and some additional fields. Okay? Again, the details don't matter because there are many, many examples, and they're all different details. In particular, I'll give you some example in which the duality holds only at low energies and not at high energies. There are examples in which the duality holds at all scales. Okay. So the schematic picture that we have in mind, and this is one of the messages of the talk, is that you have a full quantum theory, and the full quantum theory is obtained by taking, for example, starting with the theory A on the right. This is SUN gauge theories with some number of flavors, and quantizing it. Okay? In the process that I just described, you have a large Hilbert space, you model by gauge invariance, etc., etc. And this quantization is a way of obtaining the semi-classical limit in which those degrees of freedom are weakly interacting. Okay? But in going from here to here, you crank up the coupling. At some stage, the coupling is going to be of order one. And the full quantum theory is not going to resemble the semi-classical limit anymore. Okay? On the other hand, there is another gauge theory on the other side. If you keep on cranking the coupling, and now it's very strong, there's another classical limit in which the theory looks like a different gauge theory. Okay? So there are two classical limits of the full quantum theory in which it looks like two different gauge theories. In particular, they have two different gauge invariances. And therefore, the gauge invariance is not really associated with the theory in the middle, which is the theory at some generic coupling of order one. It's really associated only with the specific limit of that theory. So this theory here on the right is associated with the limit in which the quarks and gluons are weakly interacting. And this theory on the left is associated with the theory in which the dual quarks and gluons are weakly interacting. In that limit, the original quarks and gluons are very strongly interacting, and this description is very, very misleading. Okay? So this is the picture of duality. And this is, again, just one example. Question?
Sorry?
This particular
case. Yeah. This is the theory, right? You have Lagrangian. It's an SUN gauge theory, so it has a non-abelian gauge.
The full quantum theory.
No.
So you don't have the quantum theory.
You don't have the quantum. That's a point. That's right. That's right. So in order to compare the two sides, you have to rely on quantities that you can calculate at strong couplings.
So would you agree that if I said that this is a one-problem, actually right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And I'll come back to that point. Lee?
Yeah, so just to ask the same question, you might discuss a Daniels theory coupling matter non-curative, but the only information we have is about space.
That's right.
So you're stating conjecture that there's an isomorphism between lattice gauge theory defined on the left and lattice gauge theory defined on the right.
That's right. So the only thing that we can calculate which compares the two sides are, again, things that you can calculate at strong couplings, and therefore you need supersymmetry. So you're restricted to certain holomorphic, as you know, holomorphic quantities. But everything seems to agree. I should say in general, I give here things that have a lot of evidence in my mind, but there's no proof of any of that. This is just clues. This is just some indications of a deeper structure.
Do you have any example that you really know everything?
I don't have an example in which you know one side rigorously. So the question is no. The answer is no. Okay, but again, this is clues that we're getting from investigating those theories. And basically what we think about is that the physics can be formulated in many, many different variables. Some of those variables are very well suited to some particular classical limit of a theory. Some other variables are very well suited to another classical limit. And in order to look for physical questions, we should look for things that don't depend on precisely which set of variables we're talking about, but questions are properties of measurable physics. Okay? Okay, so I should say the existence of dualities was known since the 1970s. In the 1970s, there were many theories in which a picture like that applied, usually in two dimensions. Okay? But it was because essentially it was in two dimensions, it was sort of an exceptional case. But this was extended and applied to much more realistic models. Again, they do have supersymmetry. On the other hand, they're four-dimensional. They have gauge interaction. Those are the kind of theories that we think about as generic. Those are the kind of theories that we're interested in. So duality seems to be much more generic feature now than it was then. So as I said, this is forcing you to think about what's the distinction between physical properties of a theory and mathematical properties of a particular set of variables. Okay, because there are more than one set of variables to describe the theory, inherently tied to a particular classical limit. This is a typo. Okay? So what about gauge invariance? So look at the SUM gauge theory I started with. In both formulation of the theory, they are gauge invariant. Okay? All physical objects are gauge invariant, as they should be. However, this is achieved in two fundamentally different ways on both sides. In one set of variables, you have the conventional way of realizing gauge invariance. You have some fundamental degrees of freedom which are by themselves not gauge invariant. In order to impose gauge invariance, you have to impose some Gauss law constraints on your large Hilbert space. Okay? On the other side, everything already is gauge invariant. Okay? So everything you do is already gauge invariant with respect to this SUN gauge invariance. Of course, it turns out that in this other set of variables, there is another gauge symmetry, and it's an interesting question why there's always seem to be gauge redundancies around. But with respect to original gauge symmetry, those variables are already singlets. They're already projected, they're already gauge invariant. Okay? So those are two ways of realizing gauge invariance. Okay, so summary of this part. By the way, how much time do I have? I don't know when I started.
So, talk should go on at 9 and then 10 minutes for discussion, but you're already using some time.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Okay, so the same quantum theory can have many classical limits, or in other words, can be the other direction obtained by quantization of different classical theories. The auxiliary mathematical objects that one uses may vary between formulations. Okay, in particular, the question of gauge invariance. Physical quantities will be the same, of course. Okay, in particular, gauge symmetries appear to be closely associated with a specific classical limit, not of the fundamental importance. For example, in the dual formulation, they're realized trivially. It's still sure that everything is gauge invariance, but it doesn't give you too much information. Everything is gauge invariance because the theory started with consists of singlets. Everything inside is gauge invariance. Okay? Okay, so this is more or less what I had to say about gauge symmetries. Now, any questions? Okay. Okay, so now back to quantum gravity. And in particular, non-perturbative string theory. So we saw again that gauge-gauge duality suggests that there are different formulations of quantum gauge theory, and gauge freedom can be realized differently. Again, either you impose the constraints in one formulation, in one set of variables, or much more trivially, if everything is already gauge invariant. Okay, so this is the main message of dualities. And for diffeomorphism invariant, which is just one gauge symmetry, everything I said before applies as well. And this is a little bit of a surprise. Okay? So again, you can have now, it seems like, you can have some full quantum theory, which has one classical limit in which it looks like a quantum field theory, generally a gauge theory, not always. Okay? But the surprise is that on the other side, it could look like, in some other classical limit, in some other set of variables, it could look like a quantum gravity theory, in the sense that it's a theory that has a diffeomorphism invariance. Okay? So the distinction that you usually make between theories that have gravity and theories that don't have gravity, this distinction is now disappeared. Okay? And similarly, what I said before, the gate symmetry, in this particular case, the diffeomorphism invariant, seems to be a property of the classical limit. It's not a property of the full theory. Okay? So now we have many, many examples of dualities where one of the sides is gravitational and the other one is not. Okay? And I think this is an additional surprise beyond that of dualities. Okay? So dualities can connect not just quantum field theories, but quantum field theory to quantum gravity. Okay? So for reasons discussed below, a little bit later, these dualities are called holographic dualities to distinguish them between the gauge-gauge dualities or between dualities in which both sides are field theories. These are called holographic dualities. The definition of that, again, is one side is a quantum gravity theory, the other side is just quantum field theory. And I'm going to discuss briefly IDSCFT, which you probably are a little bit familiar with. But I have to emphasize that there are many other examples as well. In fact, the first example was in 1990, the matrix model, now called the old matrix model. This is now also understood as a holographic theory. On one side, you have a quantum gravity theory. It's a two-dimensional theory. On the other side, you have a theory without gravity, which is a matrix model. So this is the first instance of holographic duality. It was not thought of as such. It was not talked about in that language at the time, but now it's better understood as a holographic duality. There is the BFSS matrix model from 1995, I guess. And there's little string theory. There's more general gauge gravity dualities. So again, I'm going to talk about the ADS-CFT. This is a theory with a lot of symmetries, but there are many, many other gauge gravity dualities which have less symmetries, have more interesting gauge theories, for example, confining gauge theories, et cetera, et cetera. So everything I say now is simple and symmetric because this is the simplest situation to describe, but everything I say applies to those more complicated scenarios as well. Okay? So let me talk a little bit about ADS-CFT. This is going to be the shortest introduction to ADS-CFT that you were exposed to, I suspect. So in this, and I'm going to talk about that in this language of dualities, okay? So on one side of the duality, something that looks on the classical limit is some gravity theory, and you restrict yourself to a negative cosmological constant, and you fix that cosmological constant. This cosmological constant is there once and for all. This is a super selection sector, and you don't allow that to fluctuate, okay? And there's no other restrictions on the metric or any other fields that exist in the theory. So except for the fact that this is a theory of negative cosmological constant, everything inside fluctuates, okay? So many times you think about this side of the duality as quantization of string theory on ADS space. This is a little bit misleading. You don't take ADS space and study small fluctuation around that. Rather, you take all metrics which obey this one restriction. Okay? So we fix lambda, and later, very briefly, I'm going to worry about if this is a serious restriction or not. Okay. So if we fix the cosmological constant, okay, we fix basically the asymptotics of the theory. So there's going to be a lot of things that happen in the bulk, in this picture, it's very small raw. Basically, yes. Well,
that is an additional assumption.
Yeah, okay.
It's an assumption.
It's an additional. Yeah, okay. So maybe it's better to say that I fix the asymptotics instead of fix lambda less than zero. Right. I'm going to fix a little bit more later, actually. I'll be a little bit more precise about what I mean by fixing the asymptotics. Okay? But far away from all sources, basically if you sit at very large rho, away from all the action, and you just look what's going on, okay, you are sitting at RDS space, pure RDS space, which has this metric, one of the only equations I have in this talk. Okay? And topologically it looks like this sort of soup can. You have time flowing, global time flowing upwards, and you have some coordinate that ranges from zero to infinity. It's still, in some sense, a closed box because there is a gravitational potential that could cross at infinity. I keep doing this. Okay? And the main thing about this is that this metric has a time-like boundary. Okay? And the time-like boundary is conformal to S3 in ADS5 case or other dimensional sphere in other cases. Times R, which is parameterized by the same time, the global time here. Okay? So this is what I fix. I fix this asymptotics. So again, I fix the asymptotics, but in the middle, anything can happen. Okay? And basically I have summed over all possible configuration with this specific asymptotics. Okay? But the model is not complete before we specify boundary condition because, again, the space is a boundary. You have to tell me what happens at the boundary. Okay? So schematically, and this is really schematically, because there's lots of details that are omitted here, you have a lot of fields in the bulk theory, in this sort of theory. You have the gravitational fields, but you have a lot of matter fields. You have, in principle, all the higher modes of the strings, and each one of them can have arbitrary dependence on the coordinates. I write everything for ADS5, so there is this radial coordinate, the sphere, and time, and the boundary is at rho goes to infinity. So you have to fix how this field looks like as you go to large distances. So you fix it. You have this J here, which is a function of S3 times time, and time. Time some phi universal factor. So there are lots of subtleties because things tend to diverge as you go to the asymptotic region of ADS, but these are very well understood, and it's actually a very beautiful story because it's dual to renormalization of the quantum field theory. And the question is, as always in quantum gravity, what are the things that you can calculate? What are the things that you can observe? And since this space has boundary, then there is a natural set of observables that basically live at the boundary. Okay? The only ones that are known to be diffeomorphism invariant in that type of spaces are things like partition function or more generally correlation function. But as a function of the boundary condition. So this is actually a functional of all the boundary conditions that you can have. Okay? So this is not just a number, because you can have a lot of different boundary conditions. Okay? So, a few comments about this prescription. So again, there's lots of details that one could talk about in ADS-CFT. So far, nothing I said is specific to string theory. If you have any other suggestion for quantum gravity, and if you know how to do it in asymptotically anti-de-Sitter space, everything I said so far is just going to carry through. In particular, the diffeomorphism invariant quantities you can calculate are all summarized in this partition function Z of J. Okay? So what we have is a conjecture of how particular quantum gravity theory, string theory, behaves, or how is it formulated in this particular space? But as I wrote here, it would be interesting to compare notes. And another thing is that this boundary condition can break all the supersymmetries, and in fact it was studied by many different authors, boundary condition. So if the boundary condition, there is a set of boundary condition preserves a lot of the symmetries, but you can also investigate the theory with boundary condition that breaks all the symmetries that you want, including, for example, time translation invariance. So the boundary condition could be time dependent. Okay. Questions, by the way, since I allowed myself this? Yes.
Yeah, well, of course, this is a long discussion that we often have. It's very good to explain it. So I think that there are many kinds of learning variables that are not necessarily functions in the boundary that you describe. For example, give me a number of functions of the curvature, give me some set of curvature scalars, I pick four of them, I look for an event in the bulk which, or this is five-dimensional, five of them, I look for an event in the bulk which is characterized by those five scalars, and I measure some other scalars there.
Okay.
And given that there is an influence of initial conditions that you haven't mentioned, or it might be that this is inside of a white hole and there's no, and this information that doesn't reach the boundary, there are certainly diffeomorphism variance variables of this kind.
Okay.
There are certainly many of the kind we described, but there are also many which are not of the kind we described.
Okay, so let me make a general comment, which is, first of all, I'm looking forward to comments about this talk later after, because I think there's more discussion to be had than we have time for. Secondly, for this concrete question, all I have to say is that it could be repackaged. The observables that you mentioned could be repackaged in terms of these quantities that I mentioned. Okay?
And there is an ongoing discussion about this, and I think that there's a huge disagreement on that.
Okay. Okay. But in any event, those are at least part of the diffeomorphism invariant observables, and those are the ones that are packaged in the gauge theory. So we fix the condition at asymptotic region, but in the bulk, absolutely anything can happen. Any local process that you want can happen. And lambda, the constant, can be as small as you want. So if you're interested in any sort of local process, for example, the formation and evaporation of small black holes, this seems like a very good description. The restriction that we imposed on the cosmological constant is mild. On the other hand, for global issues, for example, cosmology, if you want to describe FRW universe and you're interested in the physics of the whole universe, then this restriction is not so mild. Okay, so now comes the CFT. If your quantum gravity theory is string theory, turns out that there's another way of calculating this. So this is at least part of the diffeomorphism invariant observables, possibly all of them. And this could be calculated in terms of a completely different set of variables. Those are packaged in some gauge theory. So again, there's supersymmetry there, which I suppressed in the discussion. So basically, you calculate this partition function the way you do it in gauge theory. So this is a very good thing because you know how to quantize gauge theory. So you do a path integral over all gauge degrees of freedom weighted by some action, which is basically the non-abelian SUN gauge theory, plus additional things that have to do with supersymmetry. Okay? And in particular, these J's, the boundary values of the field, now come as sources in this partition function coupled to some operators. Okay? And the operators here are a complete set of all the gauge invariance operators of the theory. Okay? So J are now assume a dual role. Instead of boundary values of the field, they are now sources for gauge invariant operators. And there's one gauge invariant operators for each string field in the bulk. Okay? For example, if you're interested in the dilaton, it's a particular scalar that appears in string theory. It has a boundary value, which is a scalar in the boundary as well. And this turns out to source this particular gauge invariant operator, which is part of the Lagrangian. Okay? So there is a one-to-one correspondence between, oh, that was a question of 5 minutes. Okay, so I better hurry. Okay. So there is a one-to-one correspondence between all the boundary values of string fields, in particular all string fields, and all the gauge invariant operators that conform from the fields of n equal 4 super Young Mills. And this is just one example of things that would invalidate the correspondence if they were not true, but are true by some sort of miracle, okay? This is a basic requirement, this one-to-one correspondence. Now, the gauge symmetry is defined here on S3 times R, and this is precisely the conformed boundary. So in some vague sense, which could be made a little bit more precise, it's associated with the boundary of that space-time. So this is a general feature that happens a lot in gravitational dualities, that the dual theory is always some non-gravitational theories defined on some lower dimensional surface, which you can identify as some surface sometimes called holographic screen in that space-time, and that surface usually sits very far away. Okay, so the metric fluctuates in some bulk, and you observe it from very far away. So this is just one example, the time-like boundary. There are other examples as well. So this is why those dualities are referred to as holographic dualities. Okay? Let me skip this. So let's accept that as at least part of the truth. So now we have in the gauge theory a partially background independence formulation. Okay? Why is it partially background independent? We have fixed the asymptotics. We fixed the cosmological constant, the negative cosmological constant. By the way you see that it's fixed and it can fluctuate is that in this correspondence, the cosmological constant is mapped into the rank of the gauge group. So when you have a gauge symmetry, when you have an SUN gauge theory, in the usual formulation, you don't let N, first of all, it's discrete, and in any event, you don't let it fluctuate. So this is a dual statement that this cosmological constant has to be fixed. But otherwise, anything can happen, as I said before. Now, let me skip this. Let me just say, let's open a discussion later whether this is enough or not. But let me ask a different question, which I find more interesting, which is, this is partially background independent. Maybe it's enough, maybe it's not enough, maybe one can do better. Hopefully one can do better. But I think it's an interesting question to ask, how is that background independence, the partial background independence, achieved? So in one side of the duality, there is a way of presumably achieving background independence, which is more labor intensive. You just quantize gravity theory, string theory, or any other gravity theory with this particular boundary conditions. And you impose diffeomorphic invariant on states, as you should. And you have to be very, very careful not to use any particular background. And this is the part that's very difficult. Okay? But we do have that other way of achieving that partial background independence in the gauge theory. So diffeomorphic invariance that doesn't act on the boundary, the bulk diffeomorphic invariance, is realized here trivially. This is exactly the same as in the gauge-gauge duality. Okay? Everything in the boundary theory, the quarks, the gluons, the scalars, everything is diffeomorphic invariant already. Okay? And therefore, achieving background independence, in particular quantizing without using any specific background in the bulk, is easier. Okay? Okay. Any questions? Okay. Seems like I'll finish on time. Good. Okay. So conclusions. So our experience with non-perturbative quantum physics suggests this modified role for gauge freedom, including diffeomorphism invariance or general covariance. So again, this is the picture I had before. You had some full theory, okay, and you have some classical limits. And in the classical limits, they're formulated in terms of different variables, and our basic intuitions about these variables, the way we visualize things, is very, very different, okay? But nevertheless, the full quantum theory is the same. Okay. So there are two ways in particular about the question of gauge invariance. There are two ways of achieving it. There is what I call the labor intensive way, or there is the easier way, which if you have a dual formulation, you can work in terms of those dual variables. And those dual variables are already gauge invariant. Okay? So that makes life easier. Okay? So in dual variables in particular, when you talk about this holographic dualities, in dual variables, achieving background independence, at least the partial background independence that I discuss, it's easier. Okay? Bulk spacetime is not part of the formulation, so automatically you don't use any of the structure of the bulk spacetime. Okay? You don't specify what the metric is in the bulk, you don't specify what the time in the bulk is, you don't specify any of those things because you already work in variables that are completely insensitive to that. Okay? So I'm returning as the conclusion to the question, why is gauge invariance so common in those? So when I had those gauge-gauge dualities or the holographic dualities, there was always some gauge redundancy there. And the question is, why do you always get something that has gauge invariance? And the most, I don't have an answer to that. The best I can come up with is that that probably has to do with locality. And indeed, this is the property that's most obscured by working in the dual variables. So in particular, if you work in the gauge theory variables to describe the quantum gravity on ADS space, locality in the bulk is very, very obscured. You sum already over all the metric, you get the answers. It's very hard to realize any local process in the bulk. Okay? So this suggests a new role for general covariance in the quantum theory. It's a way of guiding us towards the classical limit. So we would like to start with the gauge theory variables and see what does it mean to have a particular classical background in the bulk. Okay? And I'm suggesting that there is a role for general covariance in that because having a diffeomorphic invariant in that classical limit is tied very intimately with local physics in the bulk. Okay? So let me end. I guess I ended here. Okay. That's it. Thank you.
We have about 5 minutes for questions because we used some time up here. John Steph.
In this full theory, you have some sort of bundle and there's a base manifold. Right?
Yeah.
Are the points of that base manifold to be identified as the points of space time?
I'm not sure I'm following. What bundle? Which full theory?
Exactly. The full theory has some function, right? They're functions of what?
X, let's say, all right?
So what is the set of those X? Is that a lot of points of space-time, or is that not fixed?
That's not fixed. If I understand your question correctly, that's not fixed. You sum over all...
So does that base manifold have any structure? Topological? Differentiable? How do you define the base manifold?
You don't have any base manifold, I would say. I would say that you already... did the path integral over all base manifolds, and you get the physical results.
You said you don't want any space manifolds, so you just have a base manifold. What is the structure of that base manifold?
I think usually the...
No, you want four variables, at least, maybe more.
This question has two parts, and I think John is talking about ADS safety parts, so it's one of the ways to watch it.
No, I'm talking about that middle part. What is that base manifold?
Exactly.
No, it's not a manifold at all. So I think the manifold and the geometry has to do with a specific classical limit of the theory. And what's in the middle is a partition function. It's a physical observable that you measure. The way you visualize that object is tied up to a specific classical limit. So in some classical limit, it will have to do with manifolds, and it will have to do with metric and all these geometrical objects. But this is exactly what I refer to as a description rather than the physical content.
But it's also fair to say that we don't have ability.
That's right.
Thomas?
So I agree this was a conceptually very nice talk. But I think one should make some clear point in that just modding out by the gauge mask, so it doesn't get hold of background. There are many, this is the distinction between a metric and a geometry. So you model it by different models, this one is still in geometry.
Depends
on the geometry. So holography is much more than that.
No, that's right. So what I said, I think I was careful in the phrasing. General covariance is not the same as background independence, but working in diffeomorphisms in invariant variables makes it much easier to achieve that, at least partially.
What about the first question, background independence state?
As I said, this is bait and switch.
Would you agree with the following from Pavlov, that what you hear is what I know are a set of examples in some number of dimensions with some theories which are feasible for one reason or another, but it's a hint that something extremely interesting will happen that could be a way to address the kind of dependence in memory.
Yeah.
So this suggests that perhaps in a pretty consistent string theory that actually describes the way what this may happen. So very good, let's search for it. Just for the moment it isn't the nice thing.
Oh no, we don't have a fully background independent string theory. I agree with that. Yeah. But what I'm saying is that we achieve partial background independence. I think people who care about background independence should see how that incremental progress was achieved. That would provide a nice hint for the future.
Any other comments?
Mike?
It is also four dimensional, that's not an issue.
And is that you have this asymptotic, specific asymptotic form of force function. What progress is there to do something similar? That is a dual description where instead of a few more to the you have simply some sort of internal.
Yeah, so this is things that people actively think about. Obviously, the most interesting case is the Sitter space. I think the most difficult part in that is realizing what specifically you want to calculate in those spaces. Okay, so in asymptotic plate case, the observables are the S-matrix element. In the Sitter space, it's not clear precisely what your theory should calculate. So this is an issue for any quantum gravity theory. If you have a Sitter space, it's not clear what are the diffeomorphic invariant observables. So even before you formulate the answer, you should be able to formulate the question.
Okay. I think you can start preparing the next talk, but in the meanwhile, this is using the red and allowing us to
follow
questions in this section. But the other interesting thing would be as a topic of flash test.
That's right.
Now, my understanding of this is looking at it from a distance of the following. I would like you to comment on whether this is correct. Okay, if you want to have something like, if you want some invariance with some boundary conditions, then the gauge transformations are the ones which are symptotic in identity. So you take the diffeomorphism group and you model it by the ones which are symptotic in identity and that is the symmetry group. With appropriate boundary conditions, the ADS, asymptotic ADS space time, that modeled out symmetry group. Turns out to be this one, next one. That turns out to be the
global symmetry.
The ADS group, which also happens to be a conformal group.
Yeah.
And that is why one can have conformal field theories.
Right.
It's a very happy coincidence that one can do this. And that's not in your flat case, the quotient group is either the AMS group or the point vector group, depending on the boundary conditions. If not a conformal group on anything, and that is why conformal field theory is going to play a role.
That's right.
So, from this point of view, it is a little bit like looking under the lamp, it's, you know, it's for the key, in the sense that we have a tool, which is a conformal field theory, and we apply it in the context where it can be applied, which is very good.
Yeah, but that's right. It is more physically interesting to actually do the sitter, but I agree with you. But I should point out one thing, which is some of those holographic dualities that I did not discuss are asymptotically flat, but not translationally invariant. So there is some linear dilaton. So there are some examples of asymptotically flat in which the symmetry group you discussed is broken by a linear dilaton, and those things are well understood. So there are some examples of asymptotically flat one, but not fully asymptotically flat in the sense that there is some field which is still significant near the boundary.
Exactly. So it's not really standard.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's standard.